person, because it's going to be conducted outside of court at a separate time, most likely from the first examination. Under the present system, the judge and counsel can see the examiner, can see if the examiners do a careful and complete job of assessing the problems of the allegedly mentally ill person, and the defense attorney can find out what kind of questions he wants to ask the examiner in cross-examination. What did you ask him? What didn't you ask him? Why didn't you ask him these things? Were you aware of these things in his background? It's an important thing to be there. If the judge and counsel are going to have the benefit of the same knowledge under the new law, they will all have to attend the out-of-court examinations of the two examiners, most likely conducted at separate times. The attorney, judge, and examiner time under the new proposal is virtually double. The examiners are going to have to go do the examination outside of court and then come to court. Even worse, it seems to cheapen the importance of the commitment proceeding by lessening the degree of expertise required for commitment. In the future, people will be committed upon the judgment of only one non-physician examiner. There seems to be a wide impression among the members of the public that more people should be locked up and that this would generally help improve the safety of the public. The presence of bag ladies, alcoholics, and homeless people on our streets is sometimes cited as a problem requiring more people to be committed to mental hospitals. While these do constitute problems for which we should seek a solution, involuntary commitment is probably not a significant factor in resolving them. Our present mental commitment law was enacted in essentially its same form as it is now in 1973. It has been amended on only a few occasions to make it easier to commit people since that time. Specifically, in 1979, the standard was lowered from beyond a reasonable doubt to clear and convincing evidence for commitment. From 1974 through 1981, I do not recall, and I don't have any statistics here, but I don't recall any great problem in my hometown of Portland with homelessness, alcoholics, bag ladies, or violence committed by mentally ill persons. I think it is only in this decade, with the ratcheting down of social programs resulting in people being placed on the streets and under pressure, that problems seem to arise. The Oregonian, in an article on mental commitment in 1985, stated, I've attached a copy of this article because it gives you a real good overview of the problem, stated that the Mental Health Division reports that only about 50% of the mental of the people who left the Oregon State Hospitals during the 18 months before March 1985 received community health services. Because those resources are too scarce to go around, patients are locked up longer, in many cases, than would be necessary if community services were more abundant. And actually, in the top of the second column of that article, they also stated, perhaps more important quote here, but getting people off the streets doesn't make mental illness go away. It only hustles it out of sight. Most mentally ill people, however uneasy they make us, are harmless. Many with little help can live in their own homes. If we have failed, it is a failure of treatment, of funding, of follow-up. Tinkering with commitment laws may be the simplest approach, but as H.L. Mencken said, for every problem, there is one solution that is simple, neat, and wrong. So we urge you to provide the necessary resources to mentally ill people who are now being committed to the state hospital, and for outpatient care before amending a law which is now a well-balanced protection of individual rights and the needs of the state and public in its present form. Thank you. I'm sorry to take so long with all this. Okay.
Yeah, Representative Dix.
Just one question. Was there a cutback of services starting in 1981? I noticed you had 1974 to 1981.
Well, I don't have a specific one, but it's been my impression that since the recession in 1981 started, that everybody's been cutting back in all levels, and at the federal government as well. And it seems to me when people, I mean, I know there were always alcoholics on the streets and there were always a few homeless, but that's when it really seemed to become apparent.
Just one further question. Going back to the page 5, it would be section 5, where we talk about isn't an episode of either mental or physical deterioration. On line 10 there, if the word episode were removed, would you feel that would be a better definition? So read, of either mental or physical deterioration.
Well, I think everybody goes through physical deterioration after the age of 35 or something.
True. That's a good point.
I think it's just pretty vague all the way through it. Taking episode out because we don't really know what episode means would help, but I think the other things are, what you're really doing is giving a great deal of discretion to a judge and the examiners in looking at that language, because it can be thought of, interpreted so many different ways.
One further question. In your opinion as an attorney, this may be putting you on the spot, do you feel that this new standard would be held to be unconstitutional?
Well, I think it well might. I hate to give you a firm answer, but I think it's so vague that it very likely would be.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bauman.
I plead guilty to being over 35, but wondered if
I wouldn't do that.
If it's your testimony, you might not have to. If it's your testimony that, and if you know, if it's possible to read this bill so that the episode itself, just Section C itself, would ever be sufficient unto itself to result in a mental commitment in this state. Is that your reading? Is that your reading of the bill?
Is it your
reading of the bill that this subsection C on line 10 on page 5, section 5, would stand alone?
Well, you have to, a person has to have, up in line 2, you have to have a mental disorder. And then you have to be chronically, well, it, under the bill the way it is now, it doesn't stand alone. You have to have A, B, and C.
So let me ask you what your impression is reading A, B, and C all together. You had commented earlier about a fairly, you know, you made a statement to the committee that anyone over the age of 35 and in a state of physical deterioration, I don't mean to take that personally, but I am offended.
I didn't think that you were over 35.
You were talking to the other members.
That's right.
I realize. You're just going to get into worse trouble.
That's right.
you mentioned a very large group of people, and I just want to be clear, my reading of this bill is that that's substantially reduced by the combination that the imposed on line 7, a person who is all of the following.
Yes, it is reduced by that. That's true. You would have to have been in a mental hospital for twice in the last 2 years and have had and meet the criteria at the chronically mentally ill criteria defined in the back 426-495. And as I understand it, the state feels there are about 400 people who would, in fact, be committed in the next 2 years under that criteria. And presumably there's a lot of other people who meet subsection 2 and that they have a mental disorder and are chronically mentally ill and they've been in the hospital for the last 2 years. And so it's, you know, again, you're applying this to which 400 people from that population it applies to when you get down to C. And are they in an episode or not? And are they mentally or physically deteriorating or not?
Thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chuck Main.
Would you like these?
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Charles Main, and I'm representing the Association of Mental Health Program Directors. I was also the director's representative as a member of the task force appointed by Mr. Murray. I'd like to address two issues. As you're aware, the statute recommendations from the task force focus on making uniform the application of the civil commitment law among all counties. And one of the crucial parts of the bill is getting all investigators to all of the commitment hearings. And to do that with the very high caseload now going on is going to require a lot more funding. And at this time, that funding is in the governor's budget recommendations. The second crucial part, I think, of the task force recommendations is on the added criteria, and I would like to take this opportunity to clarify how I understand that and to try to unmuddy some of those issues.
I might note before you do that, we have received a letter today asking for an amendment to the language in big sub C, which would change it to read, and this letter is from Joe Murray of the Mental Health Division, and it would be to delete the words "in an episode of" and insert the word "experiencing." So big sub C would read experiencing either mental or physical deterioration. I wanted to insert that before you spoke.
Sure.
Right on it.
Okay. Or they're deteriorating. We can, yes. What we're trying to get at, and I think that this is a very one of the exciting parts about this definition is that it allows the opportunity to do many things with the same amount of money. It allows us to earlier intervene with people who have already an established chronic mental illness, who already have had two hospitalizations for that illness in the past 3 years, and now are again in a phase of deteriorating and are likely to meet the prior two criteria of either being dangerous to themselves or others or unable to provide for their own needs. You've heard mention of the 400 people that the division did a study on that showed that those 400 people actually were only a, well, it might not really be just that many. Only 400 people in the last 3 years have had two hospitalizations, state hospitalizations. Most of those likely were hospitalized for a chronic mental illness, but not all of those were committed. Some of those were there on a voluntary basis. Now, obviously, as the inability for the hospital to allow further voluntary patients continue, more and more of those will be just for involuntary commitments only, and so you get back to the dangerousness issue again. What I find intriguing about the study that the division did is that these 400 people averaged being in the hospital 75 days each episode, as opposed to an average of 35 days with the rest of the patients. And only a third of these people had any involvement with community treatment programs, meaning that we're really talking about people that are already part of the critical mass population. They're not an added group of people that we're trying to do something else to. They've been getting help in state hospitals already, and they're not being involved in community services. The idea is to try to intervene earlier before they get to the point of dangerousness again, get them involved in community services, and get them out of the hospital at least for the length of time that they've been spending there. We can use outpatient commitment. We can get them stabilized sooner. And so it allows us to treat people that are already part of our catchment, to treat them sooner, to free up some of the bed days that are being used for other people, and as you know how burdened the state hospital is, and treat these same people with community funds that we're supposed to be doing. So it allows us to do many things for the same amount of money. And that's the point mostly I'd like to make and I'd like you to hear.
Questions? Thank you.
One clarification on the dangerous criteria that was brought up earlier. I might add that if this new criteria is used, that would only affect those people who have a history through testimony from their relatives and who have a history of showing the dangerousness. Again, many people with mental illness do not have that history and couldn't be committed under this added criteria.
Well, I just a question, and since you're up here, you get asked. We had some testimony on what the word episode meant last time around, and we heard from the civil libertarian viewpoint today about that word not meaning anything very specific, and then from the mental health division, we deleted the word episode and put experience in there. Is that the solution, inserting that word, or is that just the head of the state mental health division saying, here's another word, since they didn't like the other word?
Before episode, I believe the word used was phase, in a phase of deterioration, in searching for the right adjective to use. Again, it, as many of the family members that testify before the task force, those signals that occur ahead of time oftentimes are idiosyncratic to the patient.
It
can be peculiar to the client, to the patient.
What was the word you used?
Idiosyncratic.
Oh.
For example, some people may, the signals might be that they're no longer sleeping through the evening, in addition to not taking the medicine, or they may be exploding or having a more difficult time in talking with people, or they may be withdrawing, but they may have their own peculiar signals that can be very, very predictable. And family members can, if they haven't, can certainly testify to that.
Thank you. Nancy Terry. Okay, we'll take her next then.
Who's testifying?
Marilyn Podemski. Representative of
Senator Hamby's office. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marilyn Podemski, and I am the legislative assistant for Senator Hamby. During the last hearing that was held on HB 2324, a witness named Arlene Wood testified about her experiences in obtaining treatment for her paranoid schizophrenic son. After listening to her testimony on the television monitor, Senator Hamby asked me to research the cost of his care to the state of Oregon and to determine whether the current HB 2324 would have changed the cost of his care. The research that I did is summarized on the second page of my testimony, and I have indicated in my written testimony where I obtained all that information. As you see, it is up to date, according to the figures that we were given by the relevant state officials, cost $178,765 for the treatment that Mr. Wood has received. He still has 5 years remaining on his sentence. If he had been committed in an involuntary commitment proceeding with early intervention during the first year of his illness, under HB 2324, The total cost that we received from the Mental Health Division of his care would have been approximately $80,000. So the state of Oregon would have saved $100,000 in money that they have put forward for his care. You will notice that this estimate that we have prepared does not include any of the costs of private psychiatric care that he received or of property damage that he inflicted before he was criminally prosecuted or of the numerous contacts that his family made with public agencies. If Mr. Wood remains in the state mental hospital as part of his sentence for the next 5 years, the total cost of the state of Oregon will continue to grow by at least $24,000 over what the cost of outpatient care would have been for every remaining year of his sentence. You'll notice that the analysis that we have prepared puts no monetary value on the suffering of his family or of that of Mr. Wood himself. If a price could be placed on that suffering, I'm certain that it would far exceed the money that has been spent on his care by the state of Oregon. The most significant fact about this analysis is that under House Bill 2324, Mr. Wood would not have been committed because he did not have two state hospitalizations in a three-year period of time. Thus, unless the criteria for civil commitment are broadened to include other than state hospitalizations, other Oregon families will have to go through the ordeal that Arlene Wood and her family went through to obtain care for family members who are mentally ill. He was hospitalized, according to Mrs. Wood, who's here in the audience today, twice in private mental institutions. And thus, if the word state were deleted from House Bill 2324, he would have been eligible to be committed. Thank you very much.
Maybe I misunderstood. Are you asking that immediate that on page 5, line 9, we delete the word state?
In the Senate bill that Senator Hamby has sponsored, that word state is deleted after 2 years and after studies can be made of the cost of adding those additional patients. And what her prior testimony at the last hearing indicated is that the word state was inserted because of the difficulty in trying to ascertain the relevant population. And so what we were struck by is that this patient would not have qualified.
So you want that not to occur on page 5 of this bill, but to add the sunrise provisions of the Senate bill to this
exactly.
Bill. Thank you. Nancy Terry. Sorry we missed you. That's okay.
I'm sorry. I thought you'd have a lot of questions for Chuck. This is just very short. At the last hearing on the 30th of January, I'm Nancy Terry. 790 East 32nd Avenue, Eugene, Oregon. On January 30th, 1987, three of our OAMI members had the privilege of testifying before you in support of 2325.
Arlene Wood. Can you do that without the initials so that we know who you
are? Oregon Alliance of Advocates for the Mentally Ill. Okay. At the time, we had hoped to include this booklet in our testimony and did not have it. We just wanted to emphasize that these diseases, schizophrenia or manic depression, psychosis, when it hits a member of your own family, and it does so unexpectedly, even the best of the educated among us have little understanding of the horror of these illnesses. This is an excellent series of articles done by the New York Times, and it sheds some of the insights on the problem. And, of course, we as family members are emphasizing that this is a medical problem, and the legal things are just very confusing to us.
Thank you. David Oakes.
Thank you. My name is David Oakes. I live on 366 Clark in Eugene. I'll have written testimony soon. We just got the printed copy of the bill on Thursday, and there's a lot to look at. Someone from Oami did come to our group with a rough draft, and that's how we first decided to do something about changing the bill as soon as possible. So we know that we want to have a very close look at this bill and change a number of the provisions in it that we feel hurt civil rights.
David?
Yeah.
Who is, for the purposes of the record...
The organization?
Who is we?
Who is we? Okay. I'm with a new group we just incorporated in December called Clearinghouse on Human Rights and Psychiatry. And we network with grassroots human rights groups throughout the U.S. There's about 125 groups that work on, that are consumer groups, basically, former psychiatric inmates who have been through the system. Each month we get on a teleconference call with about 40 of the groups and network with them. And I've worked in this area about 10 years have seen a lot of civil rights violations, and now with the network in place, we're hearing about problems with outpatient commitment and civil rights violations with commitment expansion all over the United States. Real briefly, some of the main problems are obviously with the commitment expansion. Twice in 3 years, we feel is an arbitrary kind of definition of someone with a problem. And deterioration likely to result is, again, a very, very broad one. The problem with privilege information, with the paying for the examiners, with liability, there's a number of other problems, and I believe that someone from the protection and advocacy system will be speaking later on, an attorney, about some of the detailed problems there. And finally, another major area is the case management provision toward the end. In fact, I'm really having a lot of fun with that one, talking to people, seeing as how it mentions bad grooming. I've been saying if this bill passes, we'll actually have ORS will actually have references to grooming in it, which I thought we had gotten done with back in high school days. Did you know that? A lot of people didn't know that grooming is in there. I find that incredible that kind of generalized stuff is in there. So I've sent you all some letters about it. And just recently I called the Mental Health Law Project in Washington, D.C. Susan Steffen, who's the staff attorney, and I have her phone number. She has a 56-page article analyzing the problems of outpatient commitment. She is willing to fly out here and testify to you from Washington. She will send that article soon, and I'll get it to all of you. But she's analyzed it, and she said right off the bat, as I read the commitment expansion over the phone, she called it outrageous, definitely unconstitutional. So the MHLP, Mental Health Law Project, is kind of the national group on mental health law. They refer specifically to the Donaldson case, you're going to ask a question?
Go ahead, finish on the Donaldson case, and then Representative Dix wants to ask you a question.
Oh, okay, sure. On the Donaldson case, 1975, Bill Taylor there asked for the citation on there. That's 422 U.S. 563, essentially established that you have to be a danger to self or others. And that was the constitutional decision on that. And that specifically is a problem with the commitment expansion. But the outpatient commitment is a whole nother ball of wax, and I can go into that in a second if I'll answer that question.
I was just going to suggest, Mr. Chair, that maybe she can prepare testimony, and I'd certainly be willing to read it rather than ever fly here.
Yeah, right. I'll tell her that. That's right.
Definitely an excellent suggestion.
I just had downstairs send it to her. Well, she's pretty upset about it. She's worked a number of years in MHLP, and she's seeing Ami pass this throughout the U.S. So far, she's studied North Carolina, Georgia, Hawaii, Tennessee, and Vermont, and she's found severe problems with all of them. North Carolina did vote in extra money for their version of the outpatient commitment, and she said however much money they put in was not enough to cover the problems. By the way, she said that an example of some of the problems that they've seen in other states is the recidivism rate is the same. through the outpatient system. So someone said, well, we'll save money with this kind of bill by being able to reach people sooner. And what they're seeing is the same kind of problems and what she called serious constitutional law problems. Basically, she sees this as what she called an end run around the right to refuse drugging issue, which I've worked on in Massachusetts and in other places. There's been a number of decisions on the right to refuse psychiatric drugs and shock treatment. And frankly, I think that they're wonderful decisions. But there's one pending right here in the state of Oregon. There's a four-year lawsuit happening with Oregon State Hospital, and there's a couple of attorneys here in Salem working on it. It's coming to a head right now. One of the clients had several hundred forcible electroshock treatments at Oregon State.